Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. This case is A21-0865 Robert Allen Keough versus State of Minnesota.
Well, before we begin, I want to thank the parties for their willingness to participate remotely in these arguments today. And even though we're not in person at the Judicial Center, those same rules apply. I do want to say a few things, though, mention a couple of things. First off, we understand there may be interruptions, technical difficulties, that sort of thing. We will be accommodating and do our best to keep those interruptions to a minimum, but understand that they do sometimes occur. Next, the clock is something that both parties should be able to view while they're speaking. From time to time, we've seen attorneys who are unable to see it. Sometimes it's because they are not in the right view. So if you toggle your Zoom to the gallery view, you should be able to see it. If you're an active speaker view, sometimes you can't see it. So I offer that piece of advice before we begin to you. I also want to remind you to state your name before you begin. And we are recording these proceedings, at least the audio portion of the proceedings. So that way we'll know who is speaking and who each party, each attorney represents. And then the last thing is that we have disabled the ability for anybody other than the judges and the attorneys to participate. There's no chat function. There's no ability to share your video or anything like that. So I just want to make sure that folks understand that and that the official recording is the audio recording that this court is doing of the proceedings. With that, Mr. Luzzo, are you prepared to begin?
I am.
All right, go ahead, Mr. Luzzo.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Adam Luzzo, and I represent the appellant, Robert Keough. The state charged Mr. Keough with the crime of violating predatory offender registration requirements, alleging that he knowingly violated those requirements by renting a garage in Hibbing, and then later by living in that garage as a secondary address. Mr. Keough's conviction must be reversed because multiple errors individually and cumulatively require reversal. Those errors include that Keough's counsel improperly conceded guilt by conceding that Keough did live in the garage, that the court gave the jurors an incorrect and misleading definition of what a secondary address is, allowing for the jurors to find him guilty even if the jurors didn't find he spent a single night in the garage, and that despite stipulating he was required to register, Mr. Keough was erroneously referred to as a predator, a predatory offender, and a sex offender throughout the trial and the exhibits that were given to the jury. I'd like to start by clarifying a fact that has to be understood to understand why counsel made an improper concession of guilt and why the other errors in the case were prejudicial and require reversal. Throughout trial, Bob Keough denied he lived in the garage. Instead, he argued he rented it only as a place to store and work on his vehicle. This denial that he lived in the garage was an essential component of his defense to the two allegations. He argued he was not guilty of the secondary address allegation because he didn't reside in the garage, meaning it was therefore not a secondary address. He relatedly argued that he was not guilty of the rental property allegation because he didn't know he needed to register property which he rented that he used only for storage space. Those two components of his defense were inextricably linked.
He didn't. Lozo, really if I can jump in to ask a quick question,
of course.
There's a related but third piece to this, and my understanding is that your client conceded knowledge that he would have to register for his residential address.
Yes, that is correct, and that's important to understanding why counsel's concession was error and why the errors were prejudicial. Because throughout the trial, he conceded and emphasized that he knew he had to register residences. That was something that defense counsel pointed to throughout trial to try to argue that he didn't have any intent or knowledge he was violating the law when he failed to register this address that he had used only for rental property. Counsel relied on that fact and pointed to the fact that Mr. Keough did have a history of registering residences.
Wasn't there a separate requirement that he acknowledged and initialed that he knew he had to register his rental property regardless of whether he lived there or resided there, Mr. Luzzo?
It's true that is a requirement of the statute, that the statute requires him to register all property rented in Minnesota.
Well, and the jury received that evidence with his acknowledgement, didn't they?
The jury received one notice of address change or a duty to register form that had a initial among all of the many, many things on those many different forms that he asked to initial. The jury did have that, which is why one of the reasons there's no sufficiency challenge in this case. But I'd point the court to the fact that there was lots of other evidence that undercut the idea that Mr. Keough knew he had to register property simply because he rented it, even if he didn't live there.
That he did not testify in this case, did he?
He exercised his right not to testify. That's true.
Sure, I understand that's his right. And I respect that, obviously. But what evidence was in the record other than the argument of counsel that he did not know he was not required to register his rental property?
Certainly, Your Honor. I'm glad you asked. So Mr. Keough didn't testify, but his statements did come in through Sergeant Everett, who testified that when he showed up at the garage, Mr. Keough took pains to try to show him, yes, I rented this place. Yes, I'm paying to be here. I can show you receipts. That in and of itself shows that he didn't know he was violating the law simply because he rented it, because he was so eager to show the police officer, yes, I rented this place.
In addition, the jury also heard testimony, I think it was from the sergeant, that he had complied. I mean, this is kind of a double-edged sword. He'd complied with registration 83 times. So couldn't the jury also consider that as his knowledge or awareness that he understood the registration requirements? I mean, I understand why it was a cross-examination question, but that kind of cuts both ways.
Well, I think it's important to remember and recognize that there are many, many different registration requirements in the statute. Certainly what Mr. Keough acknowledged and emphasized was that he knew he had to register places he lived and that he had done that plenty of times in the past. That was part of his argument. But he also argued that he didn't live in this garage and that he did not know of a requirement to register it simply because he rented it for storage. So returning to Judge Flory's question, we have Sergeant Everett's testimony about how Mr. Keough acted when Sergeant Everett showed up at the garage, which indicates that he didn't know that simply renting the garage meant he had to register it. I'll also point to the duty to register forms, which it's true, one of them accurately and completely states that requirement to register all rented property. But another one of the forms refers to that requirement as a requirement to register residences, which he has rented. That's the earlier form that Mr. Keough signed. That's the initial form that he signed when he was first starting to get to know what his registration obligations were. And that's different language than is used on the later forms. So the language on the forms conflicts. And the first one, the initial one he signed, indicates, as counsel argued at trial, that Mr. Keough had to register residences if they were residences, not just because he rented them if he didn't live there. I'll also point out that Sergeant Ronchetti's testimony about what he discussed with Mr. Keough about what he had to register is more consistent with that interpretation of the evidence, that Mr. Keough was informed of an obligation to register property he rented as a residence, but not as for other purposes.
But Mr. Lazzol, from the start of the trial, defense counsel argued, I'll quote the opening statement, one of the elements that's critical you'll have to find that the state proves beyond a reasonable doubt is that Mr. Keough had knowledge that he is required to register rental property, and with that knowledge, he decided not to do so. That's going to be the critical and singular issue for you to decide after you hear all the evidence. Isn't that how the case was characterized and tried by Mr. Keough in this matter through counsel?
Well, it says
critical and singular issue for the jury. That's what they were told out of the gate.
Well, it is true that knowledge was the critical issue, but knowledge was related to whether he lived there or not. He conceded and acknowledged that he read.
That's not what his lawyer said in his opening statement. It was knowledge of his duty to register rental property.
Right. And the fact that he didn't know he had to register rental property is shown by the fact that he did register these other properties that he did know of an obligation to register, like his residences. I don't think it can be overestimated enough how important it is that Mr. Keough's argument on lack of knowledge on the rental property allegation was based on the fact that he did show that he knew he had to register other properties. And counsel used that fact to argue, look, Mr. Keogh's updated these residential property addresses in the past. He's done what he thought he needed to do in the past. Here, because he was just renting it, he didn't know of that obligation. So it's true that his defense to the rental property allegation was that he didn't know of that obligation. But one of the things that counsel relied on to show that he didn't know of that obligation was that he had complied with his obligations that he did know of, such as registering property or registering residential properties, properties that he lived at. So
the jury obviously rejected that, and you're not challenging sufficiency of the evidence. So what's the significance of it?
Well, the significance is that the case was submitted to the jury on two different theories. There was the rental property theory and there was the secondary address theory. And so I don't think that it is obvious that the jury necessarily rejected that he knew of the rental property allegation. For instance, if you look at the secondary address instructional error, one of the reasons that it's prejudicial is because the jury was told that they could find him guilty if they found that he didn't register a property that he used for residential purposes
or Mr. Lozo,
recreational purposes.
Mr. Lozo, what is the act that would make somebody guilty here, right? What's the act under the state's theory?
Well, the state had two different theories for their single charge.
Are there two different acts?
Yes, there are two.
What are the two different acts? Because it seems to me that the act is the same. It's not registering this piece of property, right? You're not registering it under one characterization of property, and you're not registering that same property under a second characterization of property, but it's still the same property that wasn't registered.
Well, but the fact, but Mr.
So what are the, I guess, let me back up. What are the two different acts? If you're making a distinction between the acts themselves, what are those two acts?
Well, so as the state pointed out in its brief, what you're dealing with here is a mental act. You're dealing with a knowing failure to do an act. And there are two different things that the state alleged that Mr. Keogh did. The state is alleging that Mr. Keogh knowingly, that he knew that he had to register rental property, regardless of whether he lived in it, and that he failed to do that. The state is also arguing that Mr. Keogh knew that he had to register secondary addresses and that he failed to do that. So what this crime criminalizes is a mental act, a knowing failure to do a requirement of the registration statute. And those are two different things that Mr. Keogh was supposed to have known of and disregarded. And that's very important in this case because he did have two defenses to the two different acts. As Judge Flory pointed out, if it was proven that Mr. Keogh knew of the rental requirement to register any property that he rented, regardless of how he used it, it would have been very difficult for the jury to not find guilt on that, because there was a lot of evidence that Mr. Keogh did enter an agreement to rent this property. But of course, his defense was, I didn't know of that requirement because it was not a place that I lived. And that's why the errors in this case are so important, because as we just talked about, the secondary address instructional error allowed the jury to find Mr. Keogh guilty regardless of whether it allowed the jury to completely disregard that first allegation of guilt and focus just on the secondary address allegation and find him guilty regardless of whether he ever spent a night at the place, which was something the state had to prove that they had no evidence to prove. The state had no evidence to prove that this was a secondary address. And the instructional error that relieved them of the burden of proving that allowed the jury to find guilt without finding either critical element of the offense, either that he knew he had to register it because it was rented property or that it was a secondary address as the statute actually defines.
So as I listen to you right now, Mr. Lozo, it sounds to me like we're kind of blending your jury instruction objection and the specific unanimity argument that you've made here. And I understand your arguments on both of those from your briefing. My question on the specific unanimity argument that you've made is this: if we were to agree with you that there was a problem and that specific unanimity was required here, that would seem to mean that we would reverse and remand for a new trial at which the district court judge could separate those two acts out, if you want to call them that, submit two separate counts, and that conceivably a jury, if it found proof beyond a reasonable doubt on retrial, could convict your client of two felony counts of failure to register. Would you agree that that could be a likely outcome, or a likely, like, what that's what could happen on retrial if we were to agree with you on the specific unanimity issue?
So on retrial in this case, I wouldn't agree with that, because Mr. Keough can't be convicted after a successful appeal of a, of an additional conviction to what he was originally convicted of. I do agree that the state could have
I don't understand what you just told me.
Well, Mr. Keough, like any defendant who wins a successful appeal, can't receive a harsher sentence or a harsher outcome at retrial.
How would that be a harsher outcome? This is what relief you're requesting.
Well, if he's convicted of two convictions at a retrial, whereas in the first proceeding he was only convicted of one conviction, that result is barred by the rule that he can't be convicted of two offenses when he only had one conviction at the first trial. He can't receive harsher outcome.
Can you point me to authority for that?
Well, Your Honor, I don't have a case name off the top of my head, but it is well-established black-letter law that he cannot receive a harsher outcome at a retrial after a successful appeal.
He can't receive a harsher sentence. I agree with that. But you're asking us to say there should have been two counts instead of one, and we want a new trial. It seems to me that would be a likely result if we were to agree with you.
Well, my argument is not that he should have been charged with two counts. My argument is that having been charged with one count but alleged two acts, there should have been a specific unanimity instruction. I agree that in a different case, the state at the outset could potentially charge two counts because they have two separate acts that they're alleging. I don't agree that in this case, on a retrial, he could be charged with additional counts and convicted of those additional counts.
All right, thank you, Mr. Lozo. I don't see any other questions from the panel, so we'll turn to you. Is it Kenefic?
Kenefic, Your Honor.
Kenefic, I took a stab, go ahead.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Tyler Kenefic. I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. Obviously, there's a host of issues in this, and it appears that the primary focus has been on the admission of guilt or alleged admission of guilt by the defense trial counsel. So I'll focus on that. But if the court would like to direct me to any other specific issues, I'll obviously go to those.
Well, since you've asked, Mr. Kenefic, I would like you to address the failure to instruct on the definition of secondary address, since, you know, it does require proof that a person resides there occasionally or regularly. The jury wasn't given that information. It seems to me that's arguably error that is plain. So how did that not affect Mr. Keough's substantial rights going to the third plain error step?
Your Honor, it didn't affect his substantial rights because that was not the primary issue of the case. Defendant's counsel from the beginning indicated the sole issue was whether the defendant knew he had to register that address. There is no question that he had to register that address. So whether or not it was a secondary address or not, he still had to register that address. The only question is whether he knew it. And that knowledge is the same. The evidence for that knowledge is the same as the evidence for residence, is that the multiple forms that he signed indicating that he did know the requirements of registration, which included all rental property. I'd also point out that though the instructions could have been more specific, they were agreed to by defense counsel and also directly reflected the language from the statute. I would agree that the definition being included in that jury instruction would have been more specific and would have been better practice, but in this case, it was not something that affected the overall outcome of the trial. I'll move briefly to the alleged admission of guilt in this case. I wanted to kind of make clear something, that the defendant in this case was not charged with living or renting a property. It was not illegal for him to live or register or live or rent a property. It was illegal for him not to intentionally not register that property. That is the incident that is the criminal act that he was held accountable for. So when Mr. Prunovich, in this case, the trial attorney for defendant, stated that he was living there, even if that was to be interpreted as using as a secondary address, that does not admit guilt. There's nothing illegal about him living in that address. Additionally, I point out the fact that though there may be a question of whether he resided there overnight, the defense attorney did admit over and over that he spent time at that address, that he was out there and that he was present working on his vehicle. To some extent, that could be seen equally as living at an address. I mean, if someone were to spend all this time in a day at an address and then leave and go sleep somewhere else, it seems to me that that could equally qualify as living in an address. Additionally, I think the main prong that the defense attorney was getting at when he was talking about this was the perception that the residents near the garage had, that he was being specifically persecuted and overly targeted in this proceedings was, I think, one of the primary defenses by the defense attorney in this case. And in doing so, that was a rational trial strategy, considering, I think, the overall weakness of his case, because you have multiple statements indicating that he understood his requirement to register. And with that understanding that he had to register both rental and secondary addresses, there is no doubt in my mind that a conviction was going to be the end result of this case. I would move over also to the specific unanimity instruction. Also note that the trial defense attorney did not specifically request that instruction. So there would have to be a finding of plain error. As Judge Flory indicated, that if this were the case, then pretty much any case in the future where a defendant rented an address and lived at it, the state would be able to charge two separate offenses and obtain convictions for both. I think that was not the overall intent of the legislature, that simply renting an address and living at it would constitute separate violations of the failure to register. Also move on to the stipulation.
Before you move on, I'd like you to kind of respond to Mr. Lozo's characterization of the criminal conduct here as a mental act, and that there are two different mental acts, even though, yes, it's the same form, that there would be two different mental acts that constitute the two possible offenses here.
I would say the only argument for that would be if the state charged him at a point in time where he had only rented the address but had not begun using it as a secondary address. However, the state did not charge that. The state specifically charged, and the jury was instructed, that the only time that the defendant's act or failure to act occurred on February 2nd, 2018. So that was the point in time which the alleged crime occurred. And at that time, it was alleged both that it was a secondary address and that it was a rental address. And also note that the statute has been consistently held that a failure to register is an ongoing offense and is one that occurs from the time that the individual fails to register and to the point that he actually cures that failure. So while there may have been two separate acts, at the time the charge was made, it was a singular act, and it was that failure on February 2nd that was a failure to register. So I'm going to move to the defendant's stipulation to make no reference to the predatory offender, the use of the term predatory offender. The defendant's focus is on Wemyss, but I don't think Wemyss created a per se rule that simply because you stipulate to the fact that you were required to register that the use of the term predatory offender is not appropriate. It does, if the defense were to request that it not be used, I think the court would be required to do that. But here the defense did not make that request. They did not object to any time to the, well, they objected once to the predatory offender, and I believe that objection was sustained, and at no other time objected to it, either in the instructions or in the exhibits. Contrary to that, in Wemyss, the defense attorney constantly objected to it, and it was actually an evidentiary issue that was ultimately appealed, and therefore it wasn't a plain error analysis. In fact, it's not clear that a plain error analysis would apply, given the fact that Wemyss was ultimately remanded based on a misapplication of the plain error standard. The plain error standard in Wemyss they initially used was the constitutional one, which was the beyond a reasonable doubt that it would affect the verdict. But instead, the proper one was probable chance that the error would affect the verdict, which is what is used on an objected to error. So given that there's a finding that it's not a constitutional error, I don't think that there's any indication that it affects a substantial right. Unless there's any further questions, I would concede the rest of my time.
Mr. Lozo, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So to first initially respond to the idea that the state could charge and obtain convictions on additional offenses after a successful appeal, if that's the result, I'd point the court to case law, including State v. Prudhomme, that's 1975 Supreme Court case, that states first that after a successful appeal, any increase in penalty upon a retrial inevitably discourages a convicted defendant from appealing and is barred. Of course, a conviction that did not exist prior to the trial would be a penalty. And also the public policy underlying that law, as described in Prudhomme and many other cases, is that to increase the consequences that a defendant faces after a successful appeal is not consistent with the interests of justice that animate that rule that you can't be penalized for initiating successful appeal of your conviction. I would like to respond to a couple points that are also that also came up in the state's argument. First of all, regarding the question about the secondary address instruction, it's again true that Mr. Keogh's focus was on the defense was whether he knew of the registration requirement regarding to the rental property allegation. Regarding the secondary address allegation, he conceded, as we've discussed over and over in trial, and emphasized that he knew of the obligation to register residences. So when it came to that allegation, what was in dispute was whether it actually was a secondary address. And when the court failed, not only failed to tell the jurors what a secondary address was, but gave them the wrong instruction of what a secondary address was that relieved them of the burden of deciding whether he lived there, that's the reason that that was so prejudicial. Because it allowed them to decide the case by not considering whether he knew of the rental property allegation. It allowed them to decide the case without deciding whether he knew of that obligation or deciding whether he lived there, simply on the basis that it was a secondary address because he used it for residential purposes, which is not the law, but that's what the jury was told. I'd also respond to one aspect that the state's attorney discussed in arguing the attorney's concession of guilt. At one point he said that he didn't have doubt that a conviction was going to be the end result of this trial, and that therefore the attorney's concession might have been a tactical decision, trying to win the case in a difficult situation. But on this issue, the case law is clear that a consideration of whether a conviction was going to be the end result with or without the concession is irrelevant. The question on the attorney concession issue is whether the attorney made a concession of guilt, which he did by admitting that Mr. Keogh lived in this place that he had been denying throughout trial that he lived. And then the question is whether Mr. Keogh consented to that concession, which he didn't, and whether the record establishes that he acquiesced to that concession, which the record doesn't. So on that point, whether there was any prejudice, whether Mr. Keough would have been convicted with or without the concession isn't relevant. The question is,
Mr. Lozo, I think the question becomes, you know, I see your point that this is at least a partial admission, right? If the admission itself requires multiple steps, this is at least a partial one. And your point is, well, that's really the only one that was at issue. And so therefore it is an admission, but I didn't see any cases where the admission itself is broken into pieces like this and where you have a lawyer saying one piece of it. Are there cases that you cite in the brief that look at it in that way?
Yeah, so I think that there are three cases that are important for the court to consider when deciding this issue. One is Pertien, where the defense attorney admitted without his client's consent or acquiescence intent on it. This is a shooting case where he admitted he intended to fire the gun, but argued he was acting in self-defense. That was a partial concession because there was no concession that he was actually guilty. And the Supreme Court reversed because whether to admit the element of intent was the defendant's decision, regardless of whether the attorney conceded guilt on the entire charge. Similarly, and more, the defense attorney conceded the element, again, I believe, of intent and argued, well, he was acting in the heat of passion. Again, the murder convictions were reversed because it's the defendant's choice whether to concede a disputed element. And then finally, I'd point to Luby, where the defense attorney intended only to concede premeditation, but in doing so also conceded intent, conviction reversed. I'm happy to answer any other questions that the court has. Of course, my time's expired.
All right, thank you, Mr. Lozo, Mr. Kniffick. We appreciate as a panel, I'll speak for my colleagues here, we appreciate your submissions, both written and your oral arguments today. We take the matter under advisement and we'll issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.
Thank you.